Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today I'm thrilled to introduce you to Gina Madison, who's the founder and CEO of Gemtech Recruiting. Gina's a veteran recruiter with over 25 years of experience, including managing multi-million dollar enterprise accounts. Not only has Gina built a successful recruiting business, she's also a best-selling author. Her semi-autobiographical novel, A Thousand Masks, has touched the lives of countless readers. In this interview, Gina shares insights from her impressive recruiting career, including how she's navigated significant professional challenges. She also opens up about a deeply personal story of resilience that has shaped her life and her business. Gina's journey is a powerful reminder of how we can turn adversity into strength and use our experiences to help others. Here then is my conversation with the inspiring Gina Madison. Hi, Gina. Welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Hi. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Mark.
It's awesome to chat with a fellow Canadian for a change on the show.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So, although I know you recruit all over North America, but you're based in Ottawa. And I would love to start by hearing, how did you get into the recruiting business?
Sure. It was actually a little bit by accident. I'll date myself a little bit. Back in 1999, I worked for a very large recruiting company as a receptionist. And so you kind of got to see the ins and out of how things worked. In that role, I moved because I was interested. I moved into more of an administrative type role. And then actually a job opened up through the recruiting company for a full recruiter. And while I didn't have the experience, I had been in this role now for almost a year. So I joined that company, and that was in 2000. And now here we are, 2024, and I've never left the industry.
Wow, that's really awesome. I don't think I've spoken to anyone else who started out as a receptionist and literally worked your way up to, because you've been, you really senior roles in the business, and you've been doing it for 25 years. That's awesome. Really,
yes.
Really cool.
Yeah.
Tell me about your early days in a recruitment agency, jumping into a full desk. What do you think enabled you to be successful in that role?
I really think it's about personality fit, to be honest. Because I've had so much experience and I've looked at this and worked in this industry from so many different angles, It really is something you can't teach. You know, I immediately loved how working with people, I liked the excitement in the room when people were recruiting, when interviews were happening, you know, even when I wasn't yet in that role, I just enjoyed the vibe. I enjoyed how it made people feel, and I enjoyed how it made myself feel, quite honestly. And so I think that it really is about the personality fit. And it was a connection right from the very, very beginning.
Tell me about starting your own business, Gemtech, then. What inspired you to, after 20 years in the business, to go out on your own?
I've only ever worked for three large companies in the 24 years. Gemtech, well, in 20 years, because Gemtech's now 4 years old. But I had been in corporations for all that time. And when you work for a large corporation, you know, there are pros and cons to every employment that you choose. And in corporations, you know, there's really a lot of processes to follow. There's a lot of red tape, and there's a lot of working on MSPs and different things like that. And so for myself, I really wanted to get back to people. Just to people, and doing it in my way. You know, I had so much experience. I had a lot of people in the network that I knew, and I wanted to work with my rules, with my values, with my ethics. And so opening up Gemtech was really just my way of saying, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I believe that there is skills that are lacking in the recruiting industry that I could see. And I knew that I could fill that void with Gemtech from that standpoint.
I completely understand where you're coming from. And being able to do things in your own way, create your own systems and processes, and rather than have a lot of bureaucracy, I can totally get that. I know that in one of your previous roles, you have managed enterprise clients like American Express. And I think you managed American Express account for 10 years. What was that like, and what did you learn from that experience of working with enterprise clients?
I've worked with a lot of financial services, and American Express was an account that I took on when I first moved to the States. It was actually, I didn't realize it at the time, but it was to take on that role, to get your hands around that size of an enterprise, of an organization, and make sure that the program that, you know, us and say 20 other companies were working within, that it was being run the way American Express wanted it to be run. And so at that time, I was working for a $2 billion organization, a very large recruiting company. And, underneath that, so I took on the role. When I originally started, there was 18 people on contract. And then I ended up with 180 billable consultants at American Express. And so,
wow.
Yes, it became very big. But again, I really brought it down to the brass tactics of this being about people, right? You know, at that time, there was always, 10 or 15 people ready to take over for any role. But, that was never my go-to, is just, oh, it's not working, let's go. We're a recruiting company, we just swap and move out. I always wanted it to be about the personality fit, about the person. These are people's lives that we're working with. And so even with a company the size of American Express, it's the same approach that I took in running all of our different divisions around the United States, and running that program and that scale of project really opened my eyes not only to the corporate world, but to finance as well as to people, because that was a lot of people that I was managing, and the processes were huge.
Let's drill down on this a little more, because I think it's useful to tap into your experience of managing large accounts. So you 10x this account from 18, did I get that right? 18 people to 180 people. That's amazing. What sort of roles were they? Were they IT positions or?
Our contract was basically all IT at that time. So everybody, it was all IT. So everything from networking, engineering, project management was a huge part for American Express, business analysis. I worked a lot with networking, and ETL development was another huge division. Cybersecurity was another big division. Data analysis, data protection. So it really was encompassing everything that goes along when you think about IT.
So I guess the questions that come to mind, first of all, is navigating a big account like that where there's multiple stakeholders. How would you get consensus among stakeholders and then get them, work with different departments who maybe have different, needs and different preferences about in order to get those people placed?
American Express, of course, is huge. So there were a lot of divisions that we were servicing that don't always talk to each other. In fact, a lot of them don't talk to each other because they're just very, very, it's almost like different businesses within the business. And so managing through that really, again, comes down to what I said at the very, very beginning, is that it comes down to the personality fit. So you have to have an ability to really listen to who you're working with. You have to really make sure that you understand what the problem is, what the solutions that you're trying to fix are. Because when you're working with an enterprise large client like that, they have issues that they're dealing with that small companies, of course, don't. And so they're all different in nature. And so bringing those groups together and kind of bridging that gap, regular meetings, I would often bring different stakeholders together and actually like host a meeting within their organization. Because, one group could be asking for something and then another group, it doesn't work with them. And so you kind of have to be that bridge and bring them together and say, look, this is the situation, and really guide them through that. And it's something I do as well in my current business. I think I've done it all along, is that, you have to have the personality and the ability to bring people together. People have to be talking. They have to, even if they're not in the same room, they have to be talking and understand what the other groups are going with. So I really think it comes down to communication, really, bridging that gap sometimes between large organizations like that.
All right. Awesome. I love it. What would you say was the biggest challenge what was the biggest challenge of working with that account?
Their audit.
What was the audit? Tell me about that.
So because we were one of, I mean, there were a lot of approved vendors. I think there were probably 25 or 30 approved vendors. We were one of the biggest ones with 180 contractors, right? We were a big vendor to them. So, they came to us 1 year. I forget at what point in the 10 years that I was working with them, at what point it was. But at one point they came and said, you know, because they have rebates, that's the red tape we talk about with corporations, right? So you've got rebates you have to provide, you've got discounts. And so the management of that project, of that account really was a lot of that component, that administrative component, and making sure that we're following the process and the guidelines set by their MSP. And so they came to us as just a regular audit and said, okay, you know, you guys owe us, at this point, you owe us $10 million based on this. And, you know, it's the discounts. It's the way it works. It was the largest, I'll say, I found out after, it was the largest audit that company I was working with had ever gone through. And, it took 2 years. And that's a long time to go through an audit. And it was really, the audit ended up coming down to me, right? Because how did I manage it? Did I manage those rebates appropriately? Did I have the right systems in place to manage all of this? Were my teams all across the United States working within the boundaries and within the guidelines of the MSP? And after 2 years, it ended up being the most successful audit that my company had had to date. And that was within that $2 billion organization. So I was quite proud, because it came down to, I think, 0.01% of what they had came to us with. But after going through everything and the record, you know, the records that I would keep and the processes, everything that I had, managed to outline and keep record of across the United States, it came down to a 0.01%. I think it was 0.1%, if I'm not mistaken, of what the initial amount was. So it was extremely successful.
To me, that sounds like a nightmare going through an audit like that, and not the most, exciting thing to do for someone who, like you, who's a people person. But help me understand, what was this $10 million that they claimed that you owed them?
So it was that, you know, they did this with every vendor. So when you work with an enterprise large client like that, every vendor has to adhere to, you know, whether or not you have tenure discounts. You know, if they've been here X amount of time, you have to reduce your rate by X. If they're in this position, their rate has to be X. You know, they have all of these guidelines that every vendor has to go through. And so that year they had picked a handful of vendors, and it was just randomly picked. It was, you know, they came to us. So yes. So for me, who is a people person, to have to do this, but it was also exciting, Mark, in the fact that I got to see how underneath my leadership and underneath my guidance with this such a large account and so many people working with me on this as well, I got to see how good of a job I did. And that's not often you get to do that. So as tedious as that audit was, and 2 years is a long time for an audit, of course, I had a lot of financial help within the organization. But really, it came down to how we were managing against their policies and their rules. And so, you know, it was really interesting from that standpoint. It was the only audit I've ever been a part of. I'm hoping my last one, but it was so fantastic, just again, because I really got to see all the work that I'd put into managing these people, managing this account. I really got to see how well it was being followed, and to go from 10 million down to 0.1% of what they originally came to us at was something for us to celebrate. And I continue to celebrate that win today.
All right. So what you really mean is you got them to reduce that by 99.9%.
Yes. Yes.
Right. So yeah. That's fantastic. Okay. Now I understand why you're proud of that.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal. And how did they, and did they accept that?
Absolutely. Yes. And that's why it took so long, right? I mean, it was 2 years, but, and it wasn't just our organization at that time. They did this on a regular basis because that's what large enterprise clients do, as they should. They're spending a lot of money and they need to make sure that the processes are being followed. And so no, yes, that's why I was so proud of it, because it was a very huge undertaking. And it meant, honestly, at the end of the day, you know, there's not a lot of accolades in this business, like a, hey, atta girl or atta boy, you know, there isn't a lot of that. But when you're working on an enterprise client like that, that was a big accolade for myself to say, wow, underneath my program that I manage within our company, right? And then them coming and being, no, we don't owe you that amount. We only owe you 0.1% of that amount. All we had all the data to back it up. And so I was very, very proud of that at that time. And so was my company.
Question then, you mentioned that they had 25 or more approved vendors, of which you guys were one. Why do you, but, and yet you had, you seem to have had extraordinary success there in terms of billings. Why do you think you outperformed the other vendors?
I have one example that really, I think, is the epitome of one, who I am and why I am successful at what I do. And it will also answer that question. So any enterprise large client, so not necessarily just Amex, but just any client, when they have MSPs of this magnitude, when they're spending, I mean, they were spending $25 million underneath my program, right? So that's how much we were, you know, they were spending with us. So I understood why the need to make sure that everything was being followed and whatnot. But sometimes they would come to you as well. We're talking about this particular opportunity or this particular situation. They came one day and said, okay, starting Monday, all of your bill rates, everybody had different bill rates, but all of your bill rates are going down by 15%. That's a big hit when you've got 180 people working for you. And so I wasn't expecting it, of course. But again, I was in this business because I loved working with people. And so I really had to think about how I wanted to manage this, because it wasn't an ask. It was a demand. It was starting as of Monday, which it was like 72 hours away. This is what's going to happen. And with that many people, that was a lot of money. And so I reached out to a couple of my colleagues who also had contracts.
Hey, Gina.
Yeah.
Can I just clarify a couple of things before I learn how you handle that situation? So when you say 25 million, is that the margin that they were paying your company per year?
That's the revenue. So that would be what we build them.
You have to pay all the contractors out of that, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So when they're asking for a 15% reduction, is that off the top line, the revenue?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's say my bill rate was $50 an hour. It was going to go down 15%.
Okay. So that's a much bigger reduction in profit.
It is. Yeah.
That's a huge amount then, if they're asking you to reduce the bill rate by 15%. Okay, please continue. Sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure I was understanding correctly.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so what I had done, because that was such a big impact, not only for any organization, but also for all the people that I had working for me, right? And so I called a couple of my colleagues who also were, you know, this account was huge. So I had a lot of friends that also managed this account as well. And I asked them what their approach was going to be. And they said, it's already done. And I said, what do you mean it's already done? How does this happen in like a day, right? I'd been percolating and thinking of different ideas and stuff. And they said, we had HR draw up a contract and just said to every contractor I'm billing, your pay rate's going down 15% on Monday. And I was like, wow, that cutthroat, right? That was very cutthroat. And I said, well, you're going to have a lot of turnover because of this. I mean, you're going to have a lot of people looking to leave because you're all of a sudden with no notice, even though you can explain yourself all you want. But that at the end of the day, these are people, they've got families, they've got bills, and you're putting the entire burden on them. And I realized that, okay, well, for one, that wasn't going to be my approach to 180 people's lives starting in 48 hours at that point. What I decided to do without ask, I was managing the account. I was going to make the decision. And so I split it. I called every single one of my 180 contractors and I told them that this is what's happening. This is what some other organizations are doing. I've thought long and hard about this, but we're going to share it together. We're going to be in it together. Yours, your rate's going to go down 7.5 points and ours is going to go down 7.5 points. We're in it with you. That was the message, is that we're in it with you. And as much as that still is a large impact, they knew that I was in it with them and that it was my call. And so when then I had to go to my corporation and say, this was the call that I made, this is what we're doing. They were shocked at first. I don't know what would have happened if I left it up to somebody else, but it was my account. And so I took the responsibility on myself. We didn't lose a single candidate.
Wow. That sounds like quite a stressful experience, but I love the way you managed that so that, yeah, you were able to retain not just the retention of those 180 contractors, you didn't lose anybody, but also your own reputation as well, which ultimately is worth even more, right? Because that is whether people are going to work with you in the future and recommend and refer people to you and everything else. So let's switch gears and talk more about Gemtech, because that's like the managing the enterprise accounts and dealing with those situations is really interesting. But I can relate more to your experience as a small business owner, right? And the different challenges that you encounter when you're doing your own thing. So what have been sort of the real high points, and then what have been some of the challenges since you started Gemtech?
Sure. I think the one of the challenges was something I could not control. I had a client of mine who's been exclusive with me for about 15 years, and that's a long time to have a client exclusive with you. And so they came to me one day when I was with one of my previous firms, my last firm actually, and they said, we need to hire 15 or 20 people like right away. And I said, okay, I'm thinking to myself, I'd been remote and working. My company was in Phoenix and I was living in New York at the time. And I thought to myself, if I was ever going to open up my own company, this would be it. This would be a great run rate to starting my own company. So I had a very transparent conversation with my employer at the time. They knew that this company had been with me for a long time, preceding my time with them and the reasons. I mean, I've known them for a long time. And so I said, look, what do you think about this? I never wanted to leave anywhere on a bad note. So they said, you'd be crazy not to. So I said, well, what if I do this and I fall flat on my face? And they said, don't worry about it. We'll hire you back if that happens. I was like, okay. So I did it. So I launched Gemtech and I filled 5 of those roles and there were still more to come. 10 days later, COVID hit. And I was like, okay, so I never could have expected that to happen. And I did fall when that happened on my face a little bit. Of course, all those roles stopped because, well, the world was facing some very, very hard times ahead of itself. But I decided to stick with it. So while I still talked with my previous employer and they were perfectly fine to bring me back, just as they said they were, I wanted to stick it through. Mark, I working with enterprise clients, it wasn't just American Express. You know, I'd worked with the entire federal government in Canada before, like DND and DFATE and Citizenship and Immigration. I also worked with Honeywell and Google and a lot of other large enterprise clients as well. I liked running a small shop. I liked being myself and working with my set of values, my set of, just my experience and with my values really is what it came down to. And so I thought, while I was thinking about what I was going to do after COVID hit, my phone was blowing up, right? All these people, even some of them that date back to when I placed them at American Express, the world was falling apart. Everybody needed a new resume. Nobody knew what was going on. People were getting laid off. And I thought, this is when I need to step up. And I need to really help. And a lot of that help even wasn't even revenue generating. It was just help. But I had made those 5 placements and I could do it, not for long, but I could do it. And I really wanted to. Because these people, they, you know, that were calling me, they all matter to me. And it's why I'm still in this business today.
Gina, could you tell me a little bit about your unique methodology when it comes to serving clients? Because I remember reading, I'm not sure if it was on your LinkedIn profile or your website, that you have a your sort of signature solution involves extensive use of AI, but with a human touch. Could you talk about how that works?
Sure. You know, AI is everywhere now, right? And there's a lot of unknowns and some uncertainties about it. We've all seen great things that it can do. We've seen some things not so great that it can do. And so, you know, really having to learn that. I do have a senior director, Ernie Johnston, who's working with me as well. And he loves AI and the good that it can do. But he also knows, and we're in lockstep with this, that in recruiting, the human element for me and for my organization can never take a backseat to anything. And so it can be very easy, right, to say, okay, we've got AI now. Let's take a job description, match up 15, 20 resumes and tell me the best one and flip it over to your client and see what sticks, right? That is never something I would do. And so, you know, the approach is really, and I'm actually going to be talking a lot about it more on our branding and on our website and some other, you know, ways to get the message out, because I believe this from the bottom of my heart, that there is a space for AI in recruitment, but there is a space and there's a definitive line where it stops. And so that line in the beginning is great when it comes to sourcing through, say, 300 resumes that you got for a project manager role in the last 24 hours. So then you narrow it down to your top 10. That's great from an AI perspective, but it stops there. And I make it stop there because the human element, the H factor, as I call it, this is what you're supposed to do for your client, is that you take that and then you say, okay, these top 10, you look through it and then you decide who you're going to interview and you're going to send over. I only ever send over two or three resumes at most for one job. Most people don't take that approach. I do. But that's where the human element comes in, a very in-depth interview. You know, I've got 20 years, you know, over 20 years in this industry. And so I rely on my gut a lot. Within Gemtech, it's all about relationships. So the clients that I'm working with, I know them really well. And that's the whole purpose of why I'm working with them and why they're working with me, is that I want to know them. I want to know their pain points, what solution I can provide them. So AI is very important in the beginning, but I have a very, very hard stop when it comes to the age factor. And that's where myself and my team come in, where we do in-depth interviews and a personality assessment, a technical assessment, and all of those points, they still have to happen. AI will only go that far in my organization, ever.
100%. I get that. And it makes total sense. Could you share more about how you and, is it Ernie, did you say?
Ernie, yes.
Yeah. So how else you and Ernie are leveraging AI? I'm really interested in this topic. In fact, my colleagues, Leanne and Julie, are presenting a webinar called The Recruiter's Ultimate Guide to Maximize Your Billings with AI. And they're exploring the different ways in which you can leverage various AI tools throughout the recruiting process in order to increase your productivity, save time, and ultimately get better results. So I'm kind of like, this is very topical for me at the moment. I'm really curious to see, like, any specific areas where you've found AI to be particularly useful?
There's a lot of ways that it can be useful. I mean, even just creating content and posts and making sure that you're staying relevant with what you're talking about. So, you know, I think everyone's using probably, you know, some sort of AI tool when it comes to content creation, just because I know for myself, I use it minimally, but it is very helpful because there's so many other sides to the business as an entrepreneur and as a small organization that I have to spend my time on. And so AI, in the way that we're using it the most, is from that sourcing perspective. You know, Ernie has come up with this approach that I absolutely love, and he's so fascinated with AI. And so he's come up with this approach in a way to say, okay, here's the job description. Here are X amount of resumes that people have submitted. Let's rule out the ones that are clearly not a fit, because we all know, I mean, there's a lot of people looking for work right now. And, you find that you'll post a job and sometimes half the people that apply don't meet the qualifications that you're looking for. It doesn't matter what questions you ask in the job description, doesn't matter how you word the job description, people are just going to click apply, apply, apply. And I get it. People are looking for work. And I understand that, you know, but there has to be a way that we as the sort of the go-between, how we're really servicing our clients and what their needs are, and as well the candidates, right? The candidates equally need to be placed into an organization that is right for them. And so AI, I find, is extremely important from that perspective. And it is really weeding through and taking, you know, it's helping us from that perspective, from a sourcing perspective, and making sure that the resumes on paper match the job description. And then it's up to us to make sure that the personality part, the personal fit, the client fit, the environmental fit, that that's all there. And that's the H factor. But the AI part is the sourcing part. And it's pivotal. It's changed a lot of things.
Okay, really interesting. Are you able to say a little more about the workflow there? Like, is it, and which tool you're using? Is it ChatGPT or is it something else that you're using to do the initial sifting and identify which candidates actually do meet your client's criteria?
ChatGPT is one that we're using there, but there are a number of platforms that I'm sure Ernie could probably talk a little bit better about. But I know for sure that we're using ChatGPT. But our ATS system, our applicant tracking system, also has a part. I mean, I think AI is almost layered into every single program now. So, you know, whether it be LinkedIn and you want to send AI messages, things like that. So I think it's layered in everywhere. But I also want to say, I think we have a responsibility to be very careful with it, because, you know, you can overlook somebody very easily with the wrong keystroke as well. And so, you know, one of the things that I find is really important for myself when it comes to AI and Ernie as well, is that we're doing it right. Because if you do it wrong, again, these are people and it's their lives and whether or not they get a job. And so there's a responsibility on all of us, especially I feel in recruiting, so important, because these are people's lives and you don't want to overlook somebody because you made an error in it. So I think we have a responsibility there as well.
Gina, I love you obviously are a hugely positive person. And that's like the overwhelming feeling I'm getting from you, is like you have this like huge positivity. Looking back, what's been like the greatest adversity that you've had to navigate?
Well, I do have a book out there, it is inspired by true events. And so, you know, I'm quite open about it because I have my own website and I share these things because I want to help people, right? It always, for me, it's always come down to people. So I think the biggest adversity, there's two that really come to mind that have really changed my life trajectory. That was betrayal at a very, very young age, where I had to deal with things and go through things that nobody should have to. And that sets you on a certain path, which is why I actually wrote my book. And I wrote that actually right after COVID happened, because I found myself with a little bit more free time after opening my business. But I did write the book and publish it. So, you know, betrayal at a young age is a huge adversity that I had to go through, because it sets and changes everything for you. It's like you're going in this way and then all of a sudden it's like you just took a sharp left and you have to navigate that, and you have to navigate it for the rest of your life. And then I think the second adversity was being wrongly let go from one of my jobs. I'm very passionate person about what I do. I've only ever worked for three companies. I'm very loyal to the people that I work with and the candidates and my clients. And so when I was wrongly terminated, it was a very dark time for me. But I, you know, with the resilience and the passion that you see, I decided I needed to take a stance And not only for myself, more importantly, actually, it's always about the other people. I share it in my book and I share it openly, even as I am with you right now, Mark, you know, that, you know, when you're wrongly hurt or you're abused in some way, you know, there's a lot of people who feel alone. And so I wrote the book and I talk about it openly because I don't want people to feel alone. I want people to know that there's a safe space to talk about these things. And we have to start talking about these things. So those two things in my life were extremely difficult. It could have changed everything. And it did change everything. But I've managed to come out of it, I think, stronger, more resilient, and very much about living in the moment.
Wow. So just to clarify, the book, so what's your book called?
It's called A Thousand Masks.
Okay, so A Thousand Masks. But this is it's fiction, right? The book is fiction, but obviously you drew from your own life experience to write the book. Am I understanding correctly?
Yes.
What made you decide to even write a book in the first place? That's quite it's not an everyday thing to do, right? Not many people would spend however many hundreds of hours that must have taken to put that out. What was motivating that?
I guess it always comes back to people. I feel like I'm saying it a lot, but it really is. It is that, you know, with everything that I've gone through and the stats, you know, 1 in 3 girls will be abused. 1 in 6 boys will be abused. Having been 1 of those 3, right? I felt a responsibility that I put on myself. I wanted to talk about things. I've never shied away about talking about hard things, right? And, you know, I did a podcast with this group of moms and parents in Australia. And they said, you know, Gina, you take a hard stance on sleepovers with your kids. And they'd read that somewhere, maybe one of my posts or whatnot. And I said, yeah, I do. I believe children sleep at home all the time. There's no exception to that. And they said, why? And I said, because I'm not willing to be wrong. Right. And, you know, when the lights go down, you don't know what really goes on. And with those numbers that we just talked about, Mark, most of the people who are hurt from somebody that you know, right? More times than not, by somebody that you never, ever would have thought. And so, you know, my hard stance as a parent, and I do have 2 children. So I'm not just saying it, and I don't have any children that I'm using this with. They don't necessarily love it, but it's nothing I will waver on. So I wrote the book. It was not an easy feat because it's bringing up a lot of things for me. I basically had to relive everything over again. And then, you know, in the book, I also talk about how it set me on a trajectory of self-sabotage throughout my teenage years, which is why I'm actually really lucky that recruiting found me and that I found that passion within myself, because I don't know where I would have been had I not. It's a dark path for a long time, you know, at a young age when you're hurt like that. And I really just wanted to talk about the things that people weren't willing to talk about.
Why did you decide to make it a novel instead of more like an autobiography, Gina?
It would hurt the people that were involved in all of this. And I really, you know, I was very much a good question, because I was considering doing an autobiography, but it would hurt the people. And I didn't, you know, it was my story to share, but I didn't want to bring in other people into it. So I did Inspired by True Events. I don't necessarily get into what is, what isn't, but I wanted the Inspired by True Events because it, you know, some people have said, well, why not just leave it as fiction then, right? And I said, but I want to be able to talk with it with some sort of I know what I'm talking about because I've been through it. And unless I said that, unless I was willing to put myself out there and say, I've been there, I've been hurt, I'm here to help, you know, you can't do that unless you're willing to do that. And the book, Mark, has done something for me that, and for women that are emailing me, I don't really mix the book with my business all too much right now until I kind of figure all of that out. It was just something I wanted to do and I put it out there. But more and more, actually, just last week, I was interviewing a very prominent CEO and she said, I read your book in the middle of my interviewing her. And I was like, oh, I just wasn't expecting it because I don't really mix the two. And she said, I want to thank you for being vulnerable enough to write that book. And I said, well, thank you. And, you know, do you need to talk? You know, normally when somebody brings it up, it's because they want to say something or they want to talk. And she told me that I was the first person she was telling that she was sexually assaulted at the office 5 years ago. And she hasn't told anybody.
When you were writing that book, I mean, it must have been hard to really relive all those memories. Do you feel like it helped in some way for you to heal, or what obviously it helps other people who read it and, you know, can and know they're not alone, but what did it do for you to kind of put that in writing and put it out into the world?
I don't know that, you know, I have long dealt with my trauma, you know, from a young childhood. You know, I mean, I think I was six, and then I didn't remember until I was 12. So it was from 12 and on that I've really had to deal with this in my whole life. But, you know, I don't think that it did so much as far as healing for me, but it was empowering for me to be able to share my story and talk openly about it, knowing that, or hoping rather, that it would really get out to as many people as possible, because the people that have reached out to me and the reviews that I'm getting about the book just mean something, right? And to know that I'm helping give a voice to generations of women, men, it's women are the ones that are reaching out to me right now. But, you know, it just knowing that I'm able to give a voice to people who wouldn't have otherwise done that, it's done something for me, right? Not only for myself, but for my children. You know, I have a daughter. I have one daughter and one son. And, you know, when you think about that 1 in 3 and 1 in 6, we have to protect our generation. We have to protect our children. And for me, it's just been very empowering to know that, I guess, that I was strong enough that to be able to share that story and to relive that, right? It was a year-long endeavor to write the book and to get it out there. But it was worth it. I always said, even if it helped one person, and it's helped way more than just one person. And I hope that it continues to get more, you know, continues to help more people.
Wow. I wasn't expecting the conversation to take this direction, Gina, but you definitely are the epitome of resilience for sure on many levels. And potentially empathy and why you're so good with people. You've been through a lot and you're able to relate to people at a deep level, it seems like.
I actually never thought of it that way, that it was still, again, about people. I never really sort of thought of it that way, but I guess I really just wanted to help people heal, right? Because I didn't get that. I didn't have anybody that was openly speaking about these things and to be somebody that's actually reachable. I'm reachable, right? So if I put my email out there, I put my phone number out there, that if people want to call, if they want to email, it's in my book, it's on my website, you know, that I'm there. And I really am. I will listen and I will help when I can, anytime I can.
Okay. Wow. Fantastic. Gina, this has been a very interesting conversation and I'm glad we connected. There's a lot of layers, a lot of levels to this, right? We've covered everything from, like, deeply personal to professional, and I think a common theme is navigating challenges and being resilient, and so that's been a common thread for sure. So, Gina, thanks so much for being on the Resilient Recruiter.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure, and I hope this, even our conversation, helps people as well. You know, just like you said, we've talked about a lot of stuff, but resilience, empowerment, and dealing with our issues. I think every day, I just want to kind of leave it like this as well, is that every day we have a choice on how we look at things, right? And lately, I've been seeing a lot of pain and a lot of hurt and a lot of fatality. And there's just a lot going on in the world, everywhere, right? And around the world. But we have a choice about how we think about it and how we can help. And those are choices that we can make every day. And I think that if you choose to be resilient and positive and to come at it from a place of love and understanding of other people, we'd be able to help a lot more than we think we can.